If the brain's 86 billion neurons were all randomly connected, the brain would have to be more than 20 kilometres wide to fit all those connections. Luckily for us, they are instead organised through brainscapes or brain maps. My guest this morning is Rebecca Schwartzloss. She's a cognitive neuroscientist at Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and has just published Brainscapes, an Atlas of Your Life on Earth. She explains how the brain is full of maps of the body, of our senses, how we move, and other crucial sources of information. And Rebecca isn't being metaphorical or using artistic license here. These are actual maps in your brain. And it's not just a few of them. There's a whole atlas full of maps in our brains. So, Rebecca, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
First of all, what got you hooked on brain research?
Oh, I've always been fascinated with the mind and how it works. And thinking about the brain, really, it's just a physical organ that creates all that we think and feel. And that alone is just such a fascinating idea that it's intrigued me for some time.
It's been so well studied, but I get the sense that there is still so much to learn about the brain.
Oh, yes, absolutely. That's one of the fun things about studying the brain is that the more you learn about it, the more questions you have. So as we keep diving and digging and learning more, we keep discovering new things. And that's a very exciting endeavor for scientists.
I'll get you to define better than I did what a brain map is.
Yeah, so a brain map is actually a physical thing in your brain. It's a part of your brain, a region within your brain in the tissues of your brain that represents certain information. And it does it in a way that is laid out according to what it's representing. So for example, you have a map spread out across the back of your brain, spreading across the two hemispheres, that represents what you can see with your eyes if you don't move them, so your visual field. And to kind of illustrate what that means, I tell the story of soldiers who were wounded early in the 20th century, and the bullets would go through the back of the brain and actually in some cases kind of pierce this map. And as a result, these soldiers would have a hole in what they could see. They would have this patch of blindness that corresponded to that bullet hole that had pierced their map. So that kind of illustrates how very literally these maps are physically representing what we see and feel.
How long have we known about brain maps?
So the first brain maps we learned about, we were in the late 1800s, and those were our motor maps, maps that allow us and many, many different kinds of animals to move in the various ways that we do. And in fact, right away, as soon as those motor maps were discovered, it allowed neurosurgery to begin in earnest. And people could use locations of seizures that a person who was having seizures was exhibiting to figure out where they could do surgery within the brain. And so before we really had widespread electricity or cars, we had successful neurosurgery thanks to these maps.
What would I see if I was sitting next to you and you were showing me a brain map on a screen? What would I actually see? Because map is a very evocative word, so I'm thinking atlases and maps and the outlines of countries.
That's a great question. If you were to look at the surface of the brain, you wouldn't see anything but tissue. You would see an organ. You wouldn't be able to see the map with your bare eyes. But if we use various techniques in neuroscience to help us see this map, and the reason we have to make it visible with techniques is because these maps don't represent information with darkness and light kind of pigments like a map that you would have in an atlas. They represent information with the firing of cells, of electrical impulses in the neurons that are in that tissue. And so scientists have discovered different ways of turning that electrical activity and the properties of those cells into something visible so that we can see. So there are many different ways that the maps can look depending on the technique we use to make them visible to a human eye. But when all of these show how the layout across the surface of the brain or within the tissues It parallels the experiences, the surfaces of our bodies in the case of touch, the surfaces of our eyeballs in the case of vision, and the frequencies of sound in the case of hearing, et cetera. So these kind of remarkable mini microcosms of our sensations that are planted in our bodies.
Do all animals have brain maps?
Yes, as far as we know, every animal that has a real, what you would really call a brain with enough neurons in it to be a complex brain, which by that I'm including things like Drosophila or fruit flies and mice, very small organisms. They have complex enough brains that they have brain maps. And these maps can vary quite a bit between different creatures. They can process very different types of information. But the fact that our brains all have these maps demonstrate how very important they are to us and our survival.
Yeah, I mean, if we didn't have brain maps, what would happen to us?
Well, we would have these terribly large brains that would be impossible to pick up off the floor, and it would be impossible for us to eat enough to sustain the energy that they would require. Or alternately, we could have a brain our size, the size of our brain, but it would be not able to support more than perhaps one sensory modality. So, you know, you might be able to see, but you couldn't hear or taste or sense with touch. So you have to give things up if you don't have maps. You just can't squeeze as much valuable kind of neurons into a brain and perceive as much without these wonderful maps.
Do they differ amongst people, or are the maps fairly standard?
That's a great question. And actually, it really depends. That there are some maps that are fairly universal, although even kind of the most basic maps, they might have the same location between you and I, but exactly sort of how they are laid out can be different. And in fact, there is some evidence that those subtle differences in the layouts of our maps do affect our ability to do various things, like to find a target in a complicated visual array, or to do something that requires a lot of dexterity with our hands. So these layouts of these maps, you know, we kind of shape them through experience, and then they also shape us and our capacities.
Now, you say that there are three solutions for how our hardworking brains cope with all the information that comes flooding in every day, and it feels like we're getting more information now than perhaps ever before. So let's look at the fact that the brain only perceives a fraction of the information around us. How does that work?
Yes, well, it begins with our sensory receptors, the cells in our eyes and in our skin and in our ears that collect information about the world. And so actually, although we feel like we're sensing everything, these receptors are only giving us a sliver of the information that's out there. For example, with vision, we don't see infrared light and we don't see ultraviolet light. And we don't see most of the light spectrum. We just see a sliver that is visible light to us. And similarly with sound, if you were a mouse, you would be able to hear far higher frequencies than we humans can. So even before information gets to the brain, we've already filtered it out. We are collecting the information that matters for us. And then once it comes to the brain, we further filter and sort of gather and sort of preserve the most important information. And we do that by making our maps represent those parts of our information larger. For example, our touch maps represent our fingertips and the touch information from our fingertips by actually magnifying their representation. So we have these big honking areas that represent what our fingers touch. And that's why our fingers can be so very sensitive to picking up fine details and textures.
The brain maps, they're clever things, aren't they? Because they can preserve some details and sacrifice others.
Absolutely. They are just the most brilliant, you know, brilliant kind of way of having your cake and eating it too. And no wonder so many species on Earth have these maps, because there's no downside to them. They allow you to make more with less, and that's something that creatures trying to survive always need to do.
You talk about vision again, which of course is vital for many species, and for the human brain. You're talking about visual periphery vision, and I just get the sense that some people have better peripheral vision than others. Is that related to brain maps?
Yeah, so it can be related to their retinas and their actual, the kind of information that their eye is capable of collecting. For example, some diseases of the eye can impair in collecting information in the central or in the peripheral parts of vision. But in addition, even if your eye is functioning completely normally and your vision is normal, the way that your brain maps do magnify the central part of your vision versus the periphery can be different. And that has been shown to affect your capacity to pick up details in different parts of your visual field.
Now, do we know if these brain maps are with us from birth? I mean, we know that the brain changes so much, particularly in those first few years, or are they altered as part of that growth process?
Yes. So our brains begin to form maps while we are in utero as fetuses. We have the parts of our body start sending messages to the brain, and the brain starts to kind of respond to those messages and develop the kind of beginnings of these maps. And then when we're born, there's sort of a switch in our brain. Our brain becomes much more receptive to sensory information coming in, and it begins to learn and adapt from to these sorts of inputs. And so actually that's why the experiences of in childhood and even especially in infancy can be very, very integral to how these maps develop. And because the maps then sort of, they basically crystallize, they don't completely get fixed, but they become much less able to change than a baby's maps. And therefore, sort of the early experiences can continue to sort of shape what you perceive later in life, because your time as a child building those maps was so important to what your maps are like now as an adult.
You give some examples, actually, Rebecca, saying that these malleable infant brain maps are partially what help babies be able to recover from strokes, say, better than adults can, or children born blind to compensate for their blindness in ways that adults can't. But it can also make them more vulnerable to some things.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's sort of a beautiful thing that you can take a child and can be born into an environment and sort of adapt to that environment so that, for example, a child born blind is able to take that, what would normally be a visual brain map, and kind of reuse it for non-visual purposes, because it doesn't, that child does not need the visual brain map. And that's probably usually a good thing if the child is never going to need a visual brain map. But for example, if you are able to correct what's happening in the child's eyes and restore their vision, if their brain maps have already sort of changed and are now processing different kinds of information, they will no longer be able to use those visual brain maps the way that a child who could see during those early months of their life could do. So it can be a double-edged sword. It all depends on whether you're adapting to something that is permanent or something that will change.
Can you harness your brain maps to do more?
You know, I think that your brain maps are sort of this wonderful way of understanding why, for example, when we practice things and when we do things over and over again, we get better. You know, there are ways in which you can see changes that take place because of the actions that we take and the sort of learning that happens in our brains. I would say that one thing that we do very well is we kind of reuse existing maps to do sort of more difficult thinking as adults and complex individuals having our kind of higher thought. So, for example, you can if you use your sensory maps, your visual maps, your touch maps to help you process. You also have spatial maps to help you process more complicated ideas like abstract things or large numbers, large quantities, you could make a graph or something like this and use that. It's actually much more effective for helping you to understand the information. So by being able to use these more basic sensory maps to help us represent more complex information, we're kind of able to double dip and use those maps doubly for both basic and complex purposes.
How do brain maps relate to memories? I'm thinking of that phrase, selective memory, and I'm wondering if it's a thing and maybe we can blame our brain maps for it.
Yes. Well, there are areas of the brain that are especially linked to forming long-term memories. And these areas actually, they are kind of, they operate differently. They don't actually make the kind of classic maps that I describe in the book. They operate by what's called a distributed code. But when you bring a memory to mind, and you kind of, so like say that you try to think of a particular event and then you think of that event and you remember it, that process of remembering and experiencing that memory, that is using your sensory maps to actually help you reinstantiate that experience. So in a way, when you remember, especially if you're somebody who uses visual imagery or sensory imagery, including tactile and hearing, you may actually be creating in your brain a similar experience to what you experienced when you initially had that event that you're recalling.
So why do so many of us lose our memories?
That's a great question. Memory is an elusive thing. And I think to some degree, the understanding is that if we were to remember everything, it would be overload. It would be too much information. And part of what we want to do is generalize, learn how to take many events and then kind of extract the pattern that will help us move forward without having to remember every single event. But at the same time, I think when it comes to losing those memories, we are thinking more about those population codes than the maps, because the maps, in a sense, those are like the kind of here and now of our brain, representing what's happening and what we're feeling at this moment. It sort of makes life bittersweet how we can both be in a past place at a different time, and then sometimes not be able to revisit the kind of past experiences that are precious to us.
How do brain maps deal with virtual reality?
They are often very well fooled by it. That's a great question. There have been some studies of that. I think that usually what they do is they'll kind of reflect what you are, the sensory information that you are being fed. So if you're seeing something with a virtual reality setup, then that will be kind of engaging your primary visual cortex. One of the tricky things about virtual reality is that you can kind of use some sensory modalities to trick other sensory modalities. And that's something that we've been learning more about, how information from one sense or two senses can influence what we're expecting with another sense, so that we have kind of mechanisms that tie together the sensory information that we receive. And sometimes that can lead us astray, such as with virtual reality.
Can you explain? I'm just trying to think of an everyday activity. Say if you're watching something like a movie, how does the brain map work? How does it, does its activation depend on what we're watching?
Yes, absolutely. So actually, there have been some wonderful studies that have put people in an MRI machine and scan them using settings that are able to pick up the blood flow in their brain, which tells us about where neural activity is changing as they're doing something. So as they watch these movies, we can see changes in blood flow that in different areas of the brain that represent neural activity. And that neural activity in these maps is reflecting the ongoing activity, the ongoing events in the screen. So if you, for example, see somebody reaching for a coffee cup, you're activating an areas of your visual cortex that correspond to the image you're seeing and also to the objects in the scene that you're seeing, including the hand that, and then you are also activating your touch maps as if you were picking up that cup and your motor maps as if you're picking up that cup. So you are representing the activity, the information you're seeing on the screen with many different maps. And what's kind of amazing is that if you put someone else in the scanner, their brain in these maps, the areas of these maps are highly synchronized to what your brain would be doing at that time. So kind of we have this shared neural architecture of these maps that can be very kind of similarly activated by meaning as we watch something like a movie.
Now, what are the implications? Now that scientists understand brain maps, I imagine there is potential for manipulation. So what should we be concerned about as modern technology explores how maps can be used? I mean, I know that, for example, they're looking into using brain maps to see if patients in a vegetative state are aware of their surroundings. That sounds benign and possibly helpful, but are there implications for us of this knowledge?
Oh, absolutely. So just as that discovery of that early motor map led very quickly to kind of a new opportunity to do neurosurgery, our discovery of many more maps in the brain has really opened up the kind of floodgates for developing technologies that allow us to peer into the brain and read information out of it, or to try to place information into it. For example, there have been efforts to make visual prosthetics so that somebody who is blind could have information about what they would otherwise be seeing inserted into their brain so that they can try to perceive visual input despite their blindness. Or in the case of paralysis, a lot of the work has been done in that field is trying to read information out of these motor maps and then using them to instruct robots how to move and how to, for example, feed the individual who is paralyzed and otherwise would be incapable of feeding him or herself.
I'm a bit more worried about this concept of some scientists wanting to develop direct human-computer integration.
Yes. So there are kind of dual efforts emerging, or dual kind of investment paths. There are groups that are really investing in the medical applications of this, which could be very promising and could really help people who are sidelined by brain injuries or body injuries. But on the other side, there's also quite a bit of interest in kind of the commercialization of this technology for making our lives easier or kind of cooler, that we could, for example, type by just thinking of what we wanted to type, and a kind of an interface that we wore could read out what we wanted to type, and there it was on the screen. We could kind of send instructions surreptitiously to our computer. And so that kind of technology might really appeal to some people, but I absolutely do think we should be skeptical. We should be wary of it. It's still in development. We're not at the stage yet where you could put on a cap and it could beautifully read what you are thinking. But what it is actually something that it's important for people to know is that it matters in terms of how much a company or an individual can learn about what you're thinking based on your brain activity. It matters how much they already know about you, because they can use machine learning algorithms to combine information that they have and with your neural signals and to train the algorithms to start better decoding your brain activity. So we should be thinking a lot in the future about kind of who is investing in these technologies and whether these are kind of corporations or institutions that we want to place our brain data in.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. Great to talk to you. That's Rebecca Schorsloss, who's just published Brainscapes, an Atlas of Your Life.